is currently under conservation. Scientists say the outlook for the mountain is very concerning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Emergency crews in Western Canada were still trying to reach some 18,000 people stranded by landslides and struggling to find food among bare grocery store shelves after devastating flooding. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Leyland Sesso, journalist. This article is published under the heading Canada Floods. 18,000 people still stranded in terrible, terrible disaster. Stay tuned for more. Emergency crews in Western Canada were still trying to reach some 18,000 people stranded by landslides and struggling to find food among bare grocery store shelves after devastating flooding. John Horgan, the premier of British Columbia province, declared an emergency recently. In an emotional address, the province's public safety minister, Mike Franworth, said, "This has been a terrible, terrible disaster, but I know this. As British Columbians, as Canadians, we stick together. I want to come out of this. I'm going to build a stronger, better province and a stronger and better country," he said. Appearing to fight back tears, he said, "Canadians are supporting our province, that we are one big family, and absolutely that, to me, is something that we all instinctively know. It is absolutely just a remarkable feature and facet of our communities, our people, our province, and our country." One person is confirmed dead in a landslide that swept vehicles off a road near the village of Pemberton, but with many other missing and with searches still coming through the debris, that number is almost certain to rise. Meanwhile, communities in already inundated areas brace for more rain next week. Henry Broome, mayor of the city of Abbotsford, where officials kept close watch over a pumping station, said, "I'm not concerned about today's rain. What I'm concerned about is next week and what's coming. If the pumps failed," Broome warned, "the results would be catastrophic for a community already grappling with thousands of drowned farm animals and a bill that could reach $1 billion to rebuild the city. As the military joined the effort to rescue thousands left stranded by the floods, residents say the recent days have exposed the vulnerability of small communities to natural disasters worsened by the climate crisis. When Crystal Babak got word that a wildfire was approaching her community of Merritt earlier this summer, she and her family prepared to leave as dark clouds of smoke blacked out the sky. The town was spared, but when turbid flood waters rushed through it months later, Babak knew she couldn't leave. Her mother needed care and her father was without a vehicle. I just sat there speechless. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to think. You're told to grab what you can and get out. Some people didn't even have time to grab anything," she said. As officials issued a mandatory evacuation order, she stayed behind. She and a handful of others are the few that remain in the mountain town submerged in muddy water earlier this week. The family has taken to using their motorhome as a restroom and are washing everything pioneer style in basins after the town's water treatment plant shut down. They have enough food and friends have passed them water and supplies at a police checkpoint near the town limits. With most roads closed, the majority of Merritt's 7,000 residents traveled to nearby Camp Luce, where they were told by emergency services that shelter and warm food was waiting. Soon, stories began trickling back of long lines to find shelter. Melanie Racher arrived in Camp Luce with her husband, family, diabetic mother, and elderly father to find hundreds of people waiting ahead of them to be temporarily housed. And quickly, hundreds lined up behind her. Despite promises from emergency services of the province, she would get a call. None came. We ended up sleeping in our car, and there was elderly people outside in the snow sleeping, having to wait overnight, she said, and they never got phone calls back either. Frustrated, the family drove an hour and a half east to Vernon, where they rented a hotel room. We ended up depleting my dad's savings account for the room. We are very fortunate to have the money, but we can't do this for months or weeks. We don't know how long that's going to happen, she said. With major highways washed out across the southwestern areas of the province, travelers have remained trapped for days. Ali Dexel was driving home over the weekend when she and her partner narrowly missed multiple slides that chocked off traffic and destroyed sections of the highway. She said, we spent a cold night in the car with no water left next to the mountain, which had copious amounts of water coming down off of it onto the road. We were worried there would be another landslide where we were, but we had nowhere else to go. Food was recently brought in by helicopter as Babok surveys her community, now covered by muddy debris and fresh dusting of snow. She also worries how vulnerable her family will be in the future and how long they can stay. Merritt is used to fires in the summer and floods in the spring as snow melts from the surrounding hills. But the speed and ferocity with which the water overtook the community and a fire season that stripped the surrounding hills of critical vegetation to help slow the water has left Babok in the shock. She said, the water has never done anything like this. I would have never thought that that water could come that fast. There was no time before the town was turned into a river. This has been a really big eye-opener for us. We were thinking of moving before, but this has pushed us even more. We all know the town is in a floodplain, but the fact that it can happen this fast from the rain is just unbelievable.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the people, and the region as a whole. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss security dialogue on Afghanistan, hosted by New Delhi, which sought to evolve a pan-regional response to security challenges facing Afghanistan. And we shall look at the unfolding humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, with millions of people on the brink of starvation, and how freezing of Afghan assets by the US has contributed to this disaster.
As Afghanistan continues to grapple with economic and humanitarian disasters, concerns regarding the rapidly deteriorating security situation have also assumed alarming proportions. That's what brought top regional security officials to New Delhi on November 10th to discuss the impact of the hasty US withdrawal and the stunning resurgence of Daesh in Afghanistan and the region. The participants sought to evolve a pan-regional response to security challenges facing the region and to pressurize the Taliban to form an inclusive government in Kabul.
Amidst the worsening humanitarian situation, Afghanistan has been rocked by a spate of terrorist attacks in recent weeks, sparking fresh concerns in the region. The resurgence of the Daesh terrorist group on the back of the US withdrawal from the country is particularly seen with great concern by Afghanistan's neighbors, including India and Iran. On November 10th, New Delhi convened a regional security conference on Afghanistan that saw the participation of top security officials from several regional countries. The objective was to evolve a pan-regional consensus on improving the regional security environment and to address fresh security challenges facing Afghanistan. The strongly worded declaration held complete unanimity between all eight participants in combating terrorism in all its forms and manifestations, and demanded an open and truly inclusive government that represents the will of the people of Afghanistan. It also suggested the formation of a regional coalition to push the Taliban on living up to its commitments. For India, Delhi dialogue was an attempt to reassert its regional leadership role, which apparently prompted China and Pakistan to skip the summit. While China cited scheduling difficulties, Pakistan criticized India as a spoiler. Taliban, which was not invited, welcomed the conference as being in the better interest of Afghanistan.
China and Pakistan, for different reasons, gave the New Delhi-hosted security summit a miss. And the US also stayed away, perhaps expecting an earful from other participants at the summit over its botched military adventure in Afghanistan. Iran's top security official, Rear Admiral Ali Shamkhani, who participated in the multilateral dialogue, minced no words in calling out the US for its disastrous military campaign in Afghanistan, its chaotic exit, the freezing of the country's assets, and paving the road for the resurgence of terrorist groups.
The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Rear Admiral Ali Shamkhani, represented the Islamic Republic at the Delhi Regional Security Dialogue on Afghanistan, making his country's position on security challenges facing Afghanistan and the region emphatically clear. He termed the US ouster from Afghanistan after 20 years of military occupation, marked by horrendous war crimes and human rights abuses, a disgraceful defeat. The US botched exit, he told participants at the summit, carried a lesson for others. He also slammed the US for freezing Afghanistan's assets and blamed Americans for the presence and expansion of terrorist groups like Daesh in the South Asian country. The top Iranian security official stressed that India has an important role in Afghanistan, while also acknowledging the role of other countries, including China and Pakistan. He also referred to humanitarian crisis facing the country and expressed Iran's readiness to help alleviate the sufferings of Afghans. Delhi dialogue was a follow-up to the security summit hosted by Iran previously. An Iranian initiative, it seeks to streamline regional cooperation and collaboration against terrorist groups and their backers who seek to destabilize Afghanistan and the region at large.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Hossein Askari, Southwest Asia Coordinator at Schiller Institute. Now, Mr. Askari, first of all, welcome to the program. Now, how do you assess the geopolitical significance of the New Delhi Regional Security Conference on Afghanistan?
Hello to you and your audience on the program Subcontinent. It's a pleasure for me to be with you. Of course, any such a gathering concerning Afghanistan and the situation in Afghanistan, which is so urgent, is useful. But I think this Delhi regional dialogue this time, it's more symbolic than practical. The important thing is that the regional powers acknowledge the role of India as a key partner and player in the security and strategic matters of the region, and also the problem that the fact that the Taliban were not invited, and China and Pakistan declined to attend, that creates a certain setback. But I think as a symbolic move, it's very important, especially that the security officials of the countries around Pakistan are meeting, which gives it a different sense.
So did the dialogue hosted by India manage to evolve a unified pan-regional response to the war-ravaged country's crises?
Well, not really. They are merely repeating what was said already in other such gatherings, especially the Shanghai Cooperation Organization summits. But, you know, I would like to comment on the final statement of certain points in the final statement of the Delhi Regional Dialogue, which I think are not right on the point. Point number two, it says that the suffering in Afghanistan is caused by the deteriorating security situation. It's not true. The humanitarian crisis and the difficulties are caused by the Western powers' blocking of Afghanistan's money, so Afghanistan cannot import food and medicine. And also the suffering is a result of 20 years of failures of the United States, of NATO, of the EU, Australia, and all their allies in building an economy, a resilient economy in Afghanistan, to be able to produce food, to provide the simple services and so on. Point seven of the declaration says that it's calling for an open and truly inclusive government. This rhetoric is being repeated in every meeting by everybody. I don't think this is an important point. The story is that there is a government in Afghanistan. Of course, it didn't come through elections, but de facto, there is a government in Afghanistan. What is important to do now is to stabilize the situation in Afghanistan and cooperate with Taliban to first end this humanitarian crisis, stabilize the situation, but at the same time demand that Taliban first respect the rights of the minorities, other minorities and groups, ethnic groups in Afghanistan, and two, they should immediately start a reconciliation and national dialogue to plan for the coming period.
Now, Mr. Askari, do you think the summit attended by top security officials was an attempt by India to prove its relevance as a key regional player?
Look, India is a very important country. It's a relevant country, and it has played an important historical role through the years. But it seems to me that India is suffering, under the current leadership, is suffering from some sort of an identity crisis, because it has one foot in Asia, but it wants to have the other foot in the Atlantic region. It is, you know, it's like it has, it wants to be part of the Western alliance to limit and encircle China, which is not a conductive policy. It has gone against the Belt and Road Initiative, which every country in the region, including Afghanistan, say that this is important for Afghanistan and for all, the whole region, to stabilize, to rebuild the economy and bring prosperity and security in the whole region. So India, since 2001, India did great things in Afghanistan. They built the hydropower, they built the road they built the electricity grid from Uzbekistan to Kabul to provide the electricity. They built the 200-kilometer road from Zaranj to Delaram on the Iranian border, and the Chabahar road. So therefore, they have to continue doing these things. They provided wheat, hundreds of thousands of tons of wheat. They should continue doing this kind of work, but not under the leadership of the Atlantic alliance, but in cooperation with the neighboring countries.
Mr. Askari, China and Pakistan notably skipped the New Delhi summit for different reasons. So why are there clashing visions on Afghanistan's future between these two countries and India?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, India, Pakistan, China, and the other countries, they should throw away the idea of geopolitics. This is a product of the British Empire. It's a British concoction. All the problems in the region go back historically to the British Empire. The Kashmir problem was created by the British Empire. The Afghanistan problems have been created by the British Empire. And therefore, we should leave India and Pakistan and China, all these countries, they should move from geopolitics to geoeconomics, because it's very important for India, Pakistan, China, Iran, and others, and Afghanistan to build economic ties. And there should go ahead and build the Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India pipeline. They should at the same time connect the Iran, Pakistan, India gas pipeline. They should start there. They should not wait to solve all the old historical political problems, but they should start with normalization of relations by connecting the countries of the region with infrastructure, roads, electricity, gas pipelines, oil pipelines, water management systems. This is what our Schiller Institute is calling for. We just had a conference in the United States where we both called for the unfreezing of the money of Afghanistan, but also to help integrate Afghanistan into the Belt and Road Initiative, the New Silk Road, and that all countries, including India, should be part of that, with Iran, with the Central Asian nations, and Russia, and so on and so forth.
Mr. Askari, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Dmitry Solodov, a spokesperson for Russian Embassy in New Delhi, expresses gratitude to India for hosting the security summit on Afghanistan and says Russia's stance is in line with Delhi declaration. Indian journalist and author Stanley Johnny notes that New Delhi lacks the clout to influence or oppose Taliban, so it has to work with Russia and Iran, the two key players who want stability in Afghanistan. Sushmit Patil, an international affairs analyst, quotes Iran's top security official, Rear Admiral Ali Shamkhani, saying that the U.S. must pay reparation to people of Afghanistan for the 20-year military occupation.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
People in war-ravaged Afghanistan have been tormented by grinding poverty and hunger for decades. But since the botched exit of the U.S.-led international forces and the sweeping takeover of the Taliban 3 months ago, the country has been teetering on the brink of a major humanitarian catastrophe. UN agencies have already sounded alarm bells, warning that millions of Afghans could run out of food before the onset of the upcoming harsh winter, as well as around 1 million children being at the risk of starvation and death.
That 20 years of foreign military occupation brought nothing but misery and despondency to the people in Afghanistan is clearly evident now. 3 months after the US-led coalition hastily abandoned the country, millions of Afghans are on the brink of starvation, with no food and no money. Parallels are already being drawn between Afghanistan and Yemen, the two strategically located, mineral-rich countries plundered and destroyed by foreign aggressors.
Afghanistan, almost 23 million people are marching towards starvation, 8.7 million on famine's door. 95% of the people don't have enough food. It's a crisis. It's a catastrophe.
With nearly the entire population teetering on the brink of grinding poverty, global humanitarian watchdogs are sounding the alarm over the likelihood of mass starvation across Afghanistan. A top official of the UN World Food Programme has termed it the worst humanitarian crisis on earth, while a senior executive of the UN Development Programme has described it as the worst humanitarian disaster he has ever seen. These statements point to the gravity and magnitude of the unfolding crisis, with about 97% of the 38 million population sinking into an abyss of poverty. Among those at risk include 4 million children under 5 who are staring at severe malnutrition. And worse, tens of thousands of people are getting displaced. The Norwegian Refugee Council this week reported that up to 300,000 Afghans have made their way to Iran since August, fleeing poverty and death.
Afghanistan did not plunge into this crisis situation overnight. It has been in the making for decades, essentially manufactured by the foreign powers that invaded the country in October 2001 and patronized and funded militia groups in decades before that. Its policy hasn't changed a bit. Having left the country, the US government has now found a novel way to strangulate poor Afghans by freezing their assets and blocking international aid while issuing statements of concern over the unfolding crisis in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan was already battling drought and a large number of Afghans were already vulnerable to food crisis before the Taliban led a sweeping takeover of the country in August. But the impending famine is the direct result of the chaotic withdrawal of US-led international coalition forces. Even the New York Times, which has effectively played its role as the devil's advocate, recently admitted that the crisis in Afghanistan was in large part American-made, fueled by deliberate policy choices with results that were predicted months in advance. Soon after the Taliban laid siege to Kabul mid-August, US and its international partners raced to cut off Afghanistan's access to international aid and froze roughly $10 billion in assets belonging to the country's central bank. The move triggered the rapid collapse of public finances and precipitated the current crisis. European Union also then followed the suit, stopping development assistance to the country, followed by the International Monetary Fund and World Bank. Calls are growing for the US to unfreeze funds that has led to the collapse of Afghanistan's domestic economy, even as 38 million Afghans stare at death and starvation with the onset of harsh winter. Human rights activists say statements of concern won't suffice. Real action and practical steps would.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Tara Rayner O'Grady, Secretary General of Human Rights Sentinel. Now, Mrs. O'Grady, welcome to the program. First of all, Afghanistan is teetering on the brink of a worst humanitarian catastrophe with millions without food. So what should the international community be doing to avert the impending crisis?
Thank you for having me join your show. I'm very honored to be here and for my voice to be included in this discussion on Afghanistan. I believe Afghanistan was effectively hijacked as an entire country and administered by external interests who ensured through military intervention that resources continued to flow through and out of the country. It may not be possible to completely avert the crisis the people face this season, but it could be effectively managed in partnership with those approved international NGOs who need safe access to the country and who seek to alleviate the existing suffering and who can hopefully assist with improving relations within the community through consistent communication and cooperation with the Taliban authorities to ensure that adequate food, medicine and fuel reaches those who are the most vulnerable and who are already struggling.
Now, do you think it was the US or the US-led coalition that paved the way for this disaster?
Certainly, by abandoning the country in the manner that they did, the United States lost an incalculable amount of money by ditching weapons, technology, and logistical supplies at military compounds and forsaking thousands of people who had contributed years of valuable work and who were committed to improving life in the country for those who stayed after that initial post 9/11 occupation. This created a deadly situation for many Afghani families. But I would ask your viewers to consider for a moment that America is not in great shape herself, with literally thousands of homeless families, millions without work and struggling, an unmitigated drug problem, rampant gangland murders, blue and white collar crime, and further millions without access to any form of adequate health care. So really, America cannot continue to be seen either as a beacon of hope on the one hand, or indeed as the root of all evil on the other. They have taken for granted an impossible and incredible status on the global stage, when in actual fact, their own enormous internal issues are difficult to cope with. And because the new administration recognized this and has acknowledged it, their international agenda has shifted, and they are focusing more of their energy and resources back towards themselves. While undeniably the US coalition did certainly pave the way, in a manner of speaking, for this disaster we are watching unfold, it surely cannot have been a foregone conclusion. There are many regional allies with significant finance at their disposal to invest in or donate to Afghanistan, but there must be some treaty or mechanism developed with the Taliban who must prove that they are willing to respect human rights, particularly women's rights, and to show that they're able to govern in a way that none of the other ethnic groups can feel marginalized.
Now, Mrs. O'Grady, a recent report estimated that nearly 23 million of the country's 38 million people will not have enough food to get through the harsh winter. Now, instead of showing concern, shouldn't the US move to unfreeze the Afghan funds?
This looming humanitarian catastrophe has two sides, and it presents one of those very difficult dilemmas for donor communities. For me, it raises the question of reparations. On a personal level, it would seem prudent to me that those states who contributed to the disastrous situation that has manifested in Afghanistan should be held accountable and pay reparations for the damage that was caused to every level of Afghani infrastructure. We cannot justify giving credibility to rulers who took a country by force, but the Taliban are almost reluctant conquerors. They're still in the honeymoon phase of this administration. And the freezing of assets was done by the US Treasury as a means of leverage to influence and, frankly, strong arm a change in the Taliban's behavior, but it's clearly not working. Therefore, the US needs to be creative on how these sanctions could be developed in a more sophisticated manner and designed in a way that would not affect the general public, which really seems a virtually impossible task. One proposal that I've heard suggests that sectors such as health and education should be exempt from the sanctions. We will just watch how it is unfolding and continue to try to pressure for some reason and sense around that.
On that note, I would like to thank Mrs. O'Grady for being on the program. And now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan says he has been warning of the humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan while urging the international community to act swiftly and avert the impending crisis. Azad Issa, a US-based journalist, slams Western countries and international bodies for suspending aid to Afghanistan and blocking access to its foreign assets, asking whether it is a food crisis or murder.
And that was our episode about the New Delhi-hosted regional security dialogue on Afghanistan and the unfolding humanitarian crisis in the South Asian country. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The COVID-19 pandemic could cost an extra 300,000 lives in Europe, according to a study of the number of people in 19 countries who have been neither infected nor vaccinated. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Smriti Malapati, writer. This article is published under the heading Europe's COVID death toll could rise by hundreds of thousands. Stay tuned for more. The COVID-19 pandemic could cost an extra 300,000 lives in Europe, according to a study of the number of people in 19 countries who have been neither infected nor vaccinated. The study's models also predict that the pandemic could lead to roughly 1 million hospitalizations in Europe, some of which would contribute to the projected death toll. But the authors of the analysis point out that their estimates are maximum numbers, which assume that all anti-infection restrictions are lifted and contacts between individuals have returned to their pre-pandemic levels. The analysis was posted as a preprint on the MedRevix server and has not yet been peer-reviewed. The findings suggest that the pandemic's impending toll could be quite severe in Europe and probably elsewhere, says Henrik Saldi, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Cambridge, UK, who was not involved with this study. But the figures should be interpreted with caution, he says, because the analysis assumes that everyone in the population will become exposed, an extreme worst-case scenario. Nevertheless, the study is a useful exercise in helping countries to prepare for the challenges ahead, says Cheryl Chang, an infectious disease modeler at the University of Sydney in Australia. The numbers are shocking, and they may or may not happen, but people need to be aware that COVID-19 isn't over. Countries across Europe have already experienced several waves of infection that have killed more than 1.4 million people since the pandemic began. But some 315 million people across Europe have received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. For their study, Lloyd Chapman, an infectious disease modeler at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and his colleagues wanted to quantify the impact of these past outbreaks and immunization campaigns. The researchers collected data on COVID-19 deaths in a range of age groups in countries across Europe, from which they estimated the total number of people who had been infected in each country by early November 2021. This figure, together with data on vaccination rates, was used to calculate the share of the population that had not yet acquired immunity to SARS-CoV-2 by that time, and that were therefore still at increased risk of being hospitalized or dying from COVID-19 if all restrictions were immediately lifted. The analysis also accounted for people who could still be at risk despite previous exposure or vaccination. The team observed considerable variation in the potential burden of COVID-19 across Europe. Countries in which the highest proportion of people were at risk were those with lower vaccination rates, a smaller share of people who had already been infected, and older populations. For example, some 8 out of every 1,000 people in Romania, where vaccination rates are relatively low, could still be hospitalized, compared with fewer than one per 1,000 in England. In absolute terms, around 280,000 people in Germany, which has a sizable older population, could still end up in hospital, compared with 6,300 in Denmark. The analysis sends a warning that even with relatively high vaccine coverage among eligible populations, countries can still experience waves of hospitalizations and deaths, says Lloyd. But the numbers are very much the upper limit of what could occur, he adds. However, this study doesn't take into account other factors that could increase that risk even further, such as the emergence of a new variant that escapes immunity or of immunity waning over time, says researcher. It's an elegant analysis, says Megan O'Driscoll, an infectious disease modeler at the University of Cambridge. But monitoring of the duration of protection against the disease will be critical for understanding the future long-term risks of SARS-CoV-2.
economic divide.
The subject of climate change has been discussed throughout the years and decades, so much so that you would think strides have been made. However, that is not the case. Major corporations and rich countries have fallen short in their so-called promises. Hi, I'm Kavita Afwai. In this edition of the program, we will take a look at COP26 summit in Glasgow. What happened there? Climate pledges made, did it fall short? Also, we're going to take a look at the following. The COP26 summit was something that was hailed, but the commitments by 25 nations to end finance for overseas oil and gas, well, it fell short. The catch would not take effect until the year 2022. Then, hypocrisy in action. COP26 deal lacks large coal-using countries. Study shows CO2 almost back at pre-COVID-19 level. The guilty countries that did not pledge: Australia, China, and the United States. Also, take a look at the climate protests, one of the highlights of the COP26 summit. Coal pledge, a complete joke, is what the youth climate activists said, worried they were, and rightly so, the disconnect between slow pace of emissions reductions and climate emergency.
Nothing will be saved without you. It is important to begin with the fact. You were born to be creators of the ground entrusted.
The 26th session of the Conference of the Parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change.
The opening of the COP26 summit in Glasgow. But it all came down to the final draft communique.
Well, you know, we got a very lengthy draft decisions from the presidency.
We need much more concrete action to be sure that we actually really meet this 1.5 target.
But the details of the draft showed the inconsistency with the intention of phasing out coal.
There is a reference of phasing out coal. And we are a stronger believers that that phase out of coal deserves also a deadline.
Let's take a look at some social media posts on this issue. We go straight to the U.S. with this tweet. It's from Climate Reality, which is founded by the former U.S. Vice President Al Gore. More than 250,000 Americans are exposed to levels of cancer risk above the highest limit set by the EPA. It's an environmental justice nightmare, and the culprits won't surprise you. Toxic pollution from fossil fuels and petrochemical facilities. Now, we're going to stay in the U.S. and look at U.S. Senator Ted Cruz and what he said about the climate change summit that took place in Glasgow. This tweet from the Post Millennial cites how he has called out on the Democrats for the climate hypocrisy.
Not only do they not believe what they're saying, but their hypocrisy is rampant. Headed to this climate conference, these officials flew in giant jets. John Kerry has a private jet that has flown dozens of times this past year all around the country. I don't know about you, but I don't have a private jet. I don't believe any of the people on this stage have their own private jet.
Portland does.
Yeah. John Kerry, when asked about his private jet, said, really, for someone like me, it's the only way that makes sense to travel. What dripping, condescending arrogance.
Joining us here in this segment is Robert Evans. He's a former member of the European Parliament. He is a British Labour cooperative politician who served as a member of the European Parliament from 1994 until 2009. He was first elected to the European Parliament for London North West, and then in 1999 and 2004 for the London constituency. Okay, Robert, welcome. Taking a look at what the U.S. Senator Ted Cruz has said about U.S. hypocrisy, slamming his fellow senator like John Kerry and other world leaders as a whole, on traveling on jets to this COP26 Glasgow summit. Does he have a point there?
Yeah, I think it's sending entirely the wrong message. I realize the challenges that some global leaders have getting from A to B or getting from their own country to Glasgow, but I think it's sending entirely the wrong message when they arrive in private airplanes and use private jets to go around. Most of these airlines have flights that could have come to London where they could have got a train, or a number of people could have managed it. Using private airplanes, which are private jet, very, very carbon expensive, is entirely, not so much unnecessary, but it's sending completely the wrong message to everybody else. We had the situation where our Prime Minister Boris Johnson came back to London by private jet. Well, I looked it up. There were six possible scheduled airline flights that he could have taken, or a train from Glasgow to London. And we cannot have one rule for them and one rule for everybody else. So I think global leaders needed to reflect on that. Whatever the challenges, there's plenty of airlines that could have accommodated them.
Well, what Robert says there makes sense. It sounds fair enough. But herein actually lies the hypocrisy of what the U.S. Senator Ted Cruz has said. He received actually more money from oil and gas companies in 2018 than any other senator. Ted Cruz received nearly $800,000 from the oil and gas industry in the year 2018. And actually, when it comes to U.S. senators, one in four, that is, U.S. senators, still hold fossil fuel investments. The households of at least 28 senators own a combined minimum of $3.7 million and as much as $12.6 million in fossil fuel assets. Now, let's take a look at this tweet. It says, the vicious spiral of global debt leaves countries at the front line of the climate crisis, unable to respond to its fallout. And the failure of the world's richest countries to lift the burden exposes their climate hypocrisy, as stated by the Tribune. When it comes to the COP26, it has actually exposed rich countries' debt hypocrisy. And that is where the problem is. Last year, $372 billion flowed out of lower-income countries in debt repayments. These are vital resources that could have been directed to tackling the climate emergency and the pandemic. Instead, lower-income countries are now paying five times more in debt than they are spending on fighting the climate crisis. Luca Lacoboni is a campaign manager for energy and climate, Greenpeace Italy, who joins us here to give his take on this. Luca, thanks for joining us here. When you take a look at the developing countries, there was a lack of representation. Why was that at this COP26 summit?
Most affected countries, so the countries that actually see climate change impacting their daily life almost every day around the world, are those countries that are less represented in the COP also in Glasgow. And this is absolutely unacceptable, because the richest countries are those who are less feeling the impacts of climate change and should hear the voices of the most affected countries and of the most affected people. This is another important sign of the fact that at the moment, also the COP26 in Glasgow is doing a lot of words, but really not enough actions.
All right, thank you very much for that. Luca telling us his reason for why they were underrepresented at the COP26. Now, do you know how much money was spent actually to fight the COVID-19 pandemic? How much money was spent saving businesses and governments and countries from actually crashing? Well, the Prime Minister of Barbados at the COP26 summit shed light on that and how there could have been a solution already in reducing global warming to the desired 1.5 degrees Celsius goal.
The central banks of the wealthiest countries engaged in $25 trillion of quantitative easing in the last 13 years. 25 trillion. Of that, 9 trillion was in the last 18 months to fight the pandemic. Had we used that 25 trillion to purchase bonds, to finance the energy transition, or the transition of how we eat, or how we move ourselves in transport, we would now today be reaching that 1.5 degrees limit that is so vital to us.
Our final social media post is about a social media giant that has changed its name to Meta, namely Facebook. A campaign advisor placed a large melting iceberg sculpture next to the Capitol building in Washington. This group said that Facebook had played a major role in not stopping the spread of climate disinformation.
Actually, climate disinformation is rampant on Facebook. There's 1.3 million views of climate disinformation daily. Facebook says that they send 100,000 people to their climate information center every day. But if we look at their numbers versus the numbers that we're getting from the researchers, there's a massive discrepancy of how much climate disinformation there really is on their platform.
You're listening to Economic Divide. This series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Time now for our in-depth section. When it comes to climate change, there needs to be strong will on all fronts, from political incentives to budgetary allocations. But with so much ground to cover on the issue, where is there a good place to actually start? Well, let's take a look at the companies that are responsible for most of the greenhouse gas emissions. You agree? That's a good place to start, I think. Taking a look at this, 20 fossil fuel companies, the major ones, they are responsible for 35%. That's a third of the greenhouse gas emissions. Okay, so we know that 20 companies are involved, so let's tackle them. I mean, if we know who these 20 companies are, then we should stop them from doing what they're doing. Well, if it was only that simple. What is needed is strong political will, then action to rein in the oil, gas, and coal companies responsible for them. Okay, let's find out who these companies are. Looking at the companies, well, there's a few of them, but let's look at the top ones. For example, Saudi Aramco, Gazprom, ExxonMobil, BP, Royal Dutch Shell, and then you have some of the other ones that are in the top. Look at how much CO2 they have actually emitted into the climate and into the atmosphere. You're looking at 480 billion tons of carbon dioxide. That's a lot of CO2. Never mind the environmental disasters that have happened over the decades. Okay, this is now where the controversy lies. The whole notion of the use of coal, oil, and gas and its detrimental effects on the climate and the environment, it was known a long time ago, as far back as the year 1965. Okay, let's go back to the year 1965. The U.S. President's Scientific Advisory Committee, it warned pollutants have altered on a global scale the carbon dioxide content of the air and the lead concentrations in ocean waters and human populations. In simpler language, fossil fuels were causing more carbon dioxide, which was altering the air on a global scale with huge risks for mankind. All right, let's move on to example number two. The head of the American Petroleum Institute issued a warning. The substance of the report was that there is still time to save the world's peoples from the catastrophic consequences of pollution, but that time was running out. So you're having warning after warning. Now, as if that wasn't enough, we're going to go now to the year 1981. This is an internal memo from ExxonMobil revealing a shocking warning. One of its managers sent an internal memo saying that the company's long-term business plans produce effects which will indeed be catastrophic, at least for a substantial fraction of the Earth's population. Well, the big oil companies, however, were not going to pass on their profits. Taking a look at the year 1989, you're looking at a company by the name of Global Climate Coalition. It's a coalition, actually, that was formed. Not an environmental group, like the name may suggest. It worked, actually, to sow doubt about climate change. How did it do it? It lobbied lawmakers to block clean energy legislation and climate treaties throughout the 1990s. So imagine that, to sow doubt, and that's where people doubted the effects of climate change. All right, let's get an analysis on this. Rejoining us here in this segment is Robert Evans. Robert, welcome back. The COP26 goals was to reduce net zero carbon emissions. Okay, and Paris Agreement actually did that along with other summits. However,